Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Yeah, very happy to say on Monday Night Rugby this evening, we are joined by Matt Williams. Evening, Matt, how are you?
Hey, Jai, good to talk to you again.
Asking people how they are comes with extra weight these days.
I'm above ground, which is the main thing. No, well, day 42 inside, so like all of us, online yoga and push-ups and things like that. But compared to, I'm in France, in a place, Narbonne, where I live, compared to northern France, which is very, very bad, you know, we're in pretty good shape down here.
Well, hopefully it stays that way. So we want to talk to you about the machinations ongoing surrounding World Rugby and who's going to be chairman. We have chairman versus vice chairman of the last 4 years, Bill Beament against Augustin Pichot. A source in The Guardian said they were watching each other's every move in Japan, and I've no doubt they were. The politicking is going on at all levels, I'm sure. May 13th or May 12th, we'll find out who wins. Voting is underway. A point to make off the bat is that the voting, and this is kind of emblematic of the conversation we might have, the voting is very weighted. So a Six Nations nation gets three votes in this thing. For instance, the USA gets one vote. So this is not a straightforward one vote per country kind of situation, which is very much a rugby thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's done along the tiers, tier one countries. So the Six Nations and the four in the south get three votes. Tier two countries like Romania would get two votes, and tier one countries get one vote. But not surprisingly, Japan, who hosted the World Cup, make quarterfinals, don't get three votes. So that's really what a lot of this is about, is reform within World Rugby, which is a very political organisation like the Olympics or FIFA or any of these international sporting bodies that are massive in their structures. It is a political animal. And right now that politics is very much weighed or skewed towards Europe in particular, and obviously at the head of that, the Six Nations, which was the birth of the game. So the system's put in place to keep the plebs where they are, you know. It's not, the turkeys aren't voting for Christmas here, you know.
And tied in with that, this has been very much billed as the young revolutionary against the old establishment. How true is that? Because I'm also reading that really, if you look at their manifestos, Bill Beament and Augustin Pichot, they're not all that different.
I read both the manifestos, Joe, and they're full of motherhood statements, both sides. Look, there's two giant elephants in the room, and that is the structure of the global calendar. And this, where we are currently, the structure of the global calendar is dominated by the needs and wants of the French and English clubs. So the French season starts in August and goes till June. I mean, that's just amazing. And they're basically saying, every game around the world has to basically fall into what we want. And the English clubs, not quite as bad, but not far off. So you've got Bill Beament, who is a great guy. I know Bill. To know him is to like him. He's a lovely human being. So this isn't about the person, if you like. But Bill Beament was seconded by the French Federation in his position, nominated the French Federation in his position to go for World Rugby. He chose as his running partner Bernard Laporte, who was president of the French Federation, who was seconded by the English. So at the top, they've got an English guy, an Englishman, and a Frenchman, both of whose power lies in the club system. So even though they've said they're going to reform the global playing calendar, it is highly doubtful that they're going to present anything that is of disadvantages the English clubs and the French clubs. So they're going to look after their power base. Now, the problem with the global season is the only thing in world rugby that makes money is international games. Club games, except for exceptional ones like a European Cup quarterfinal and finals, things like that. There's hardly a club in the world that makes money. We know Exeter Chiefs make money, Leinster make money. We don't think Saracens does. And if you look down in Super Rugby, there's no franchise that I know of in Super Rugby that's making money. In other words, it costs them a dollar or a euro to run the season and they make a euro. They're all making 50 cents, 60 cents. I know the Waratahs, which I know intimately because I was at the organisation for 10 years and I coached part of the coaching staff for 5 years. They've been running at a loss for the last 10 years. Now, the only way the Waratahs can function is through the Wallabies. They make money. So World Rugby, the calendar has to be reformed that we have a few more international games for every country so that everyone makes money and some less club games. We've got to find a place to do that. And the French and English are holding that back because they don't want to take their best players out to play in more international games than they currently are. So that's the two, that's the financial juxtaposition. The second part of that is the tier one countries really aren't spreading the love to the others. Like Japan is sneaking in because everyone's figuring out they're a financial powerhouse. But really they're not promoting America. The American MLR, the Major League Rugby, has got going and I think is financially stable, but really there's been nothing given to a lot of these other places to encourage it. Tier two, Romania, Georgia, Spain, Germany, Denmark. I mean, there's lip service, but not much else. And this is what it's about. It is the old versus the new, but it's really the top of Europe versus the rest. It's not north and south. It's the top of Europe versus the rest of the world.
And do you suspect Pichot would be more inclined to upset the French and English clubs?
Oh, without doubt. Without doubt. He proposed, we have to be very careful here because I don't know Gus well, but I know him because I coached against him and I knew a number of the Argentinian players through Felipe Conopani. So what I know he proposed about 18 months ago was an expansion of the international window in November. And he got white-handed from within World Rugby. So he didn't quite get what he wanted completely to put out. So they allowed him to present it, knowing pretty much that it would fail. Mm-hmm. And it did. There was a whole lot of holes in it. But ultimately, the French and English clubs, because they need the revenue. They need so many games to keep their revenue streams up. And they're not willing to reduce their number of games. And that would have had to happen if that particular model was put up. Mm. Now, Pichot and his supporters have gone back. They've been smart. They haven't come out and said, here is our calendar. Because if you put the manifesto out there, you'll just get white-handed. So they're like politicians that have a plan, but they know if they put the plan up in opposition, it'll get ripped apart by the government. So they've just said, we want to reform the annual playing calendar for the globe. You know, they haven't said to put in more international games, but they're saying to make it more financially equitable, that has to be more international games and less club games. So there's a bit of that politics going on. The second part, he said, is to change the voting structure in World Rugby so that you can't just get these clubs dominating. And the third part is there's a lot of, I'll pick my words really carefully. There's a lot of things going on in the politics and the people that get into World Rugby that is not good. And that needs to change. I won't use the word corruption, but I believe it's a system that could bring in individuals and be open to that type of corruption. I'm certainly not suggesting that anyone is doing that at the moment, but the system is open to it.
Ironically, in Bill Bowman's manifesto, there's a fit and proper person test for elected officials, and yeah. Francis Keane of Fiji, you suspect, might have failed that fit and proper persons test fairly comprehensively. So that was a major embarrassment to him. You suspect he will still get the Fijian vote. So EPCR looking after the club game here in Europe, and you're very au fait with Southern Hemisphere. We've got World Rugby. We've got Six Nations here. How do all these various atmospheres collide and work? Like, who holds the ultimate power here? I just can't believe it's really down to French club owners and English club owners. It seems ridiculous that we're almost beholden to this bunch.
Well, that's why the Champions Cup is the Champions Cup and changed its format from the Heineken Cup and... Yeah. You know, they were trying to get more of a slice of the action. They didn't like that Ireland was dominating. They tried to change that. Mate, they're running World Rugby, in my opinion. There's no two ways about that. That's the first consideration comes from those two organisations. And the rest of the place can't get their act together to oppose them. And it's very, very hard because the chairman of World Rugby, since we turned professional, has come out of the Six Nations. You know, we had Sid Miller there, who was a great man from the North, who was chairman for a while, Bernard Lapassie, who I know is a French guy. These are good guys. But they're not there. That's their power base. They're not going to turn that over. And I think they didn't have to at that stage. It wasn't as bad. The coronavirus has exposed huge weaknesses in the finances of world rugby. Look, Australia is 150 million, could be 150 million in the red. New Zealand, 100 million in the red. The club games there are collapsing. Argentina is a little different because they've basically been amateur. But I can tell you the club games in France, only yesterday, if you are in the clubs at the moment, you get what they call a chômage, which is basically the dole unemployment benefits. But in France, being what it is, it pays 80% of your wage. I mean, that's not a bad deal. But France said yesterday, look, we're going to knock that on the head in 6 months. We can't keep doing this, sending us bankrupt. So at a point, the clubs are going to be on their own. If they were on their own now, there'd be a number of clubs that are bankrupt. The second division in England is going bankrupt. The second division in France is going bankrupt. Clubs are just stop playing players.
Yeah.
Now, unless there is drastic reform in world rugby, club level will not survive. International levels, but club level just won't survive. So I suspect what's going to happen in Australia, I don't know how Africa are going to deal with it, South Africa are going to deal with it. I'm not au fait with it. But the costs of travelling to South Africa are enormous, and that could end. It could be that Australia and New Zealand go back to how it was before 95, and that's certainly been mooted that they play a Super 8 because they look like opening up a safe passage between New Zealand and Australia because they've got the coronavirus very, very much under control, probably the best part of the world to be in at the moment. It's only been 80 deaths in Australia and a handful in New Zealand. And they're talking about opening that up for sport and trade and tourism, that there'd be safe travel. So they might get their sport up and running June, July. But they're not going to go to Africa, they're not going to Japan, and they're not going to Argentina. So that'll start up. So where all these associations expand and move on to, we don't know.
Yeah.
But if you come back to the question of who's going to be running world rugby, and the proper the person to have a person of proper character on the board, that is essential. And that's the problem that we've had. But you also have the problem, especially within the Pacific Islands and some other countries, of the government taking control of the union. And that's the case in Fiji now. The Fijian Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, who led a coup, all reports are he is taking over the vote for Fiji for the chairman of World Rugby. And a report out of New Zealand is that it's that close that could be the casting vote. So we're in a situation where we're allowing people to make decisions in rugby that really, I think there are some very, very questionable characters making major or having voting rights that shouldn't. And I would suggest to you that extends into Eastern Europe as well. There's some pretty questionable situations occurring in Eastern Europe. We're seeing that at the club level, like in the last year in the playoffs to get to the World Cup. I mean, there were some horrific allegations, countries playing illegal players, suggestions of referees being accepting bribes to influence the outcome of games. So it was a game against Spain and Belgium, I think it was, with a Romanian referee. And, you know, the penalty count was outrageous. There were fights. And it should have been front page news, should have been brought out, but it wasn't. It was sort of all swept away. And there's a lot of that going on at other tiers that really is questionable.
So this thing is in dire straits then. When you unpack this thing and get right down to that level, this is going to be a serious job over the next however many years. To bring it back up to macro level for a second, and so if we're realistic about what a Pishaw or a Bill Bowman can achieve in the next 4 years, certainly they were both, including Bowman, who has the reputation of, you know, wanting to just keep things as they are. He was behind the Nations Championship proposal last year, and it didn't quite happen, and there's CVC involvement, I'm sure, as well. But is that where this is going to go one way or another, regardless of Pishaw or Bowman? United calendar, some kind of Nations Championship, whatever logistics you want to sort out, sort them out, and in a sense, try and just make a huge ton of money at the top and then distribute it whatever way we can across the game. Is that the kind of broad plan over the next 4 to 10 years?
Yeah, I would agree with that, Joe. I mean, it's not abandoning the club game. It's not abandoning the Heineken Cup. That's not the case. But it's getting it back into balance so that there can be between I think it's somewhere between 15 and 18 internationals a year, where now there's about 11. And sometimes that's a little bit more for some countries and a little bit less. It's also the summer tours and when these games occur, to getting some alignment in this. Because the other part that Pouchet wants to do, he wants to go to the players and say, what's a safe number of games for you to play? So the big reason, or one of the main reasons, the last proposed reform to world rugby came up was because the players said, geez, when do we get a break? We're going to be playing 40 games a year. And this is the problem. Now, Pouchet wants to say, get the players to agree, look, 25 is the limit, but that's going to take them out of club rugby. So if you're a top-line player like Johnny Sexton, let's take, for example, or Ty Furlong, and you're playing 20 international games a year, you're only going to get 5 for Leinster. So the clubs are going to be losing out big time on these elite players. Now, Ireland can put up with that because their whole system, their clubs are coming through to support the national team. But when you've got private owners in France and England, they don't give a rat's about the national team. Mm. They want to win. They're putting their own hard earned into it. So they're desperately opposed to this for their very own selfish purposes. There is a balance and there's a lot of detail to be had. But ultimately what it would mean is each year the top 8 to 10 countries would play each other. So Ireland would, instead of just going to Australia, Ireland would go to South Africa, Australia and New Zealand, and Australia would come over and play all the home countries as well, as would New Zealand, as would South Africa. So it would mean everyone plays each other in a calendar year of the top teams. Now, what's really scaring the Six Nations, what they really opposed it, there was a promotion and relegation from that top tier in. So it means if you have a bad year, like Italy gets pumped out and Georgia gets pumped up or Japan gets pumped up, but they don't. So what they're worried is if Scotland have a bad year and come last, they could get pumped out. And they're not going to vote for anything where they can get relegated. Because they're saying, well, we've got 150 years in of tradition here. We don't want to do it. And there's a lot of argument for that. So that promotion and relegation scared the absolute bejesus out of the top level countries. So they just weren't going for it. The second part is the Six Nations is so unique that they don't want to be having other teams into it. And I get that. I agree with that. I don't think there should be any promotion and relegation from the Six Nations. So there's some political problems to overcome within this scenario and how you do it. But simply saying we're not going to address these problems and we're not going to set up a task force to try and find a way forward that is, remember, that is financially sustainable. Because if we don't get a financially stable playing calendar, the game as we know it is finished. Mm. It is right now it is finished. It's changed forever. It's how, what is the shape of the game as we emerge from this virus, from the quarantines around the world? So how are we going to do this? And this is a massive problem. And just saying we're going to stick our head in the sand and we're going to do it the same way we've done for the last 100 years, that's not going to work. That's failing everyone in global rugby. So there are huge issues to come up. The argument for Pouchet is that he is willing to address these issues. He is willing to confront them and to talk about them and to say, is there a way forward? And include the players, the current generation of players, in the process. He's also willing to embrace the women's game and the game in other parts of the world, how the sevens calendar is put together. And why does such a short period of the year with such intense travel, why is it not expanded? And talk to the players again to get them at the table on making these decisions. Now, that's massive.
And briefly, and sorry to interrupt, if Pichot's a 10 out of 10 on that kind of determination to do that, where's Beaumont?
You know, again, I really don't know. But if we say, you know, it's like getting a president for re-election. That hasn't happened the last 4 years. We haven't had any change or any growth in that area. We've had growth in the women's game.
Sure.
But and we've had growth in a number of areas. And they took the World Cup kicking and screaming to Japan and they bitched and whinged the whole way there, but it worked. And there's pressure that they've got to take a World Cup after in the future to the Americas, which I agree. That's got to happen. Mm. But they are so conservative and we know they will protect the club game in France and England, their structures above the rest of the world. That's what we do know.
Okay.
And if we do that, we're heading for some serious failure in the rest of the globe. By all means, the Six Nations should protect the Six Nations. That's their job. And French rugby should protect French rugby. That's their job. But this is all getting at the expense of the game right through the Americas, right through the Asia Pacific, and to a degree in the Africas as well. And that's certainly not world rugby's gig. World rugby is world rugby, not just European rugby.
Okay. Before we go, the situation in Australia, people have been aware that the game has been in trouble there for some time. It's all got very messy. Probably the trends exacerbated by the coronavirus. People will have seen that 11 Wallaby captains wrote a letter in the local paper over there, and they were calling for effectively Raelene Castle, the chief executive of Rugby Australia, to be removed from her post. That was then down to 10. Michael Leiner withdrew his name from the 11. Raelene Castle has gone as chief executive of Rugby Australia. She's only been there since 2017. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you almost need to be there day to day to get a feel for how good, bad, or indifferent she was. She certainly had the misfortune to have to deal with the Israel Folau situation. She's Rugby Australia has struggled to land the TV deal they're all hoping to land. So that's been going on under her watch. Rugby Australia borrowed 9 million from World Rugby. They've saved another 7-8 million from players' wages. But there's been a bit of a backlash to her removal I've seen today, Matt. People saying this was handled all terribly. And however she did in the last 3 years, we're only talking about 3 years. This problem is something you've been talking about for, what, two decades? Certainly a decade.
Yeah, a decade. Yeah. Look, the last three CEOs of Australian rugby have done a poor job. And she's walked in to a mess. However, I have to say my attitude that she should never have been appointed in her track record. So, Raelene, and this is not about being a woman, as the misogyny cards got played here, and I can only tell you from my point that's got nothing to do with it. Couldn't care less. She was CEO of Netball New Zealand and then came across to Australia and was CEO of the Canterbury Bankstown Rugby League side, the Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs in the NRL. Very, very high profile. And she left them in a mess. She left them with a salary cap. They had a salary cap and they were over. They were a mess. So it messed up there. And that brought her into the CEO of Australian Rugby that was already in a mess. And a lot of the things were not her doing. But her position, in my opinion, had become untenable. Her relationship with the wider rugby community was not good. Now, that happens in leadership roles all the time. I thought the 10 Wallabies captains doing that was very, very poor. There were also a number of people that didn't sign. John Eales in particular was one who didn't sign, because the guy that stepped in there as chairman is a guy called Paul McLean. So We've had some really, you know, you've got to understand the board of directors in Australian rugby, I think, for a lot of it, has done a very, very poor job managing rugby in Australia for a considerable period of time. And what the problem is, everyone keeps looking at the Wallabies, and the Wallabies have been poor. But the Wallabies are poor because our structures below that are diabolical. Why are Ireland good? Because the structures in Irish rugby below that in our provinces and in our schools are sensational. They're going really, really well. And the exact opposite's happened in Australia. Our provinces have dropped because our schools have dropped, and our support of our junior program and our academies is disastrous. That's what they haven't addressed. Now, these Wallabies came in and they signed this letter. Liner pulled out because it was really bad form. They needed to get in and support Australian rugby at the time of real crisis, which it is now. Her leaving has thrown the game into more crisis. Look, there was a couple of, just so everyone knows, she was dealing with TV rights, and Fox, which is the equivalent of Sky in Australia, it's owned by Sky, was dealing at about $50 million, a little bit more or less, a year for the TV rights. They're finishing at the end of this season. Fox's first offer was $20 million. Mm. Right, so, and she rightly went out looking for other tenders, because that's, you know, wasn't even 50% of what they were getting. She had another company, Optus, this is a report, up, giving us more than $50 million. It was about $70 million. These are only reports I've read. I don't know these facts. And the coronavirus hit. And everyone walked away. So she's had Israel Folau, our failure at the World Cup, and right now there is no TV right. She's got no one. She hasn't even got the $20 million of the initial offer from Fox. So there is a disaster, and it's on her watch. But The whole thing has been, like, it's typical of Australian rugby. They played the whole thing out in public, and they've been really outrageously overt in what they're doing. Now, they might have had good reasons for it, but they've, the 10 Wallaby captains have managed this very, very poorly. There's guys I know very, very well in that group, and I got respect for some of them, and some of them I think is pretty self-serving. But the bottom line is rugby league in Australia has also lost its CEO. A guy called Todd Greenberg has resigned because of the finances of the carnivore. So she's not the only one getting this. But the way rugby has handled it, it's been very, very poor. Very, very poor. And there's some commentators that you won't have heard in Ireland that have been bullying. And it's not something that the rugby community in Australia should be proud of. And look, let's be also very honest. The overwhelming majority of people in the rugby community show don't bully and don't do that. But some people have been completely out of line.
Okay, well, that sounds like a complete mess.
Look, mate, it breaks my heart. It's been a complete mess for a number of years, and I've been saying it to you, Joe, on this show and on a number of places.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, all that is coming to the surface. It's an absolute disaster. The clubs, the Waratahs, everyone's bankrupt. I really don't know how they're going to get their way out of the financial situation they're in. It's truly, truly heartbreaking.
So if you were to round all of this up then, back into the context of Beaumont versus Pichot and the game having to really figure out where it goes now, still a young professional sport, obviously, in relative terms, it's really just at its birth. And this initial period, as we hit this COVID crisis and it kind of highlights various things, a lot of houses not being run properly, a lot of finances not in great shape, over-leveraged, very exposed. The calendar still a bit messy. Like, really, this is kind of I hate people who talk about crises as opportunities, but you know, there is something of an opportunity here to get this thing in order for the next couple of decades and get it fit for purpose, or else things could get very ugly.
Joe, when we went professional in 95, 96, it was a revolution.
Yeah.
And everyone, in every revolution, things get done wrong because they're done quickly. It's just automatic change. Club players in Ireland, the AIL, were getting paid a lot of money. I mean, that's crazy. We've been paying people to play rugby that should never have got paid to play rugby. And it's sent everyone bankrupt. All the clubs in Australia, they've all lost their home grounds. They've lost their clubhouses. The Waratahs have been going backwards for years. The Reds have been going backwards for years. And everyone just kept saying, we'll keep going. The first era of professional rugby is finished. It's over. It's gone. And we just accept that. And I agree with you. This doesn't mean Johnny Sexton and the elite end aren't going to be professional. They will be. The effect is there's going to be a lot less people will be paid in rugby. The pay will drop, and there has to be a complete restructure of the global year. So the professionals will play a global year, in my opinion, and and that might have more an impact on the South. So the South might have to play through their summer and come up here. That might be might change from being a winter professional sport to being an autumn, summer, spring time game. That means they can align with the Northern Hemisphere, and many more people will return to playing amateur rugby, which is something they should have done a long time ago, so that we have a financially stable, players have a limited number of games they play, or a set number of games they play, and the money earned at the top level will support the development and growth of the game at the bottom level. So right now, what's occurring at a finish, the money is being paid on this generation, and it's not their fault. It's the fault of the system, and there's not enough money going into the growth of the game. And that's exactly what's happened in Australia. Our junior numbers in the men's 15-a-side game have ruptured. They are just horrendous reduction in numbers, 60, 70% in areas of Sydney. That was the heartland. That was the place where we produced Wallabies. They're just not playing the game because we didn't have any money to put in development of the game. And that has to change, or it'll become an irrelevance in certain parts of the world. And that is not good for the global game. The other part is pay TV. The thought that pay TV is going to come up and solve all our problems with 300 million, 400 million, that's gone. That's finished everywhere. And the virus has done that. We're not going to get those until the business models can come back up, and that's not going to happen too quickly. So the whole income stream, the structure of everything has got to change. Why I would like to see Gus Pichot in is because he is willing to talk about it, to be inclusive, and to have the discussion. And we must have the discussion. If we don't have the discussion, we are in serious, serious trouble.
Matt Williams, as ever, thank you.
Pleasure, Joe.
Monday Night Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.